So, as you know, I think, because most of you looking around have been here over the last few weeks, we're looking and walking through the book of Exodus together, this wonderful Old Testament book that talks about God's determination to set his people free. And we've heard the story of Moses being drawn into that story, and Moses' reluctance to do it, thinking that he couldn't possibly be good enough to be involved in God's plans. And today, we're moving the story forward another notch into chapter 4, and the end of chapter 4, and then into chapter 5. So let's just read the story. I'll put the words on the screen, and then I'll just reflect on a few simple thoughts with you. So the Lord said to Aaron, "Go into the wilderness to meet Moses." Remember, Moses had been told that Aaron could be his mouthpiece because Moses was reluctant to be a speaker. So he was told by God, okay, Aaron can speak for you. You just tell him what to say. It's a bit complicated, but it's a sign of God's concession to our weakness. Lord said to Aaron, "Go into the wilderness to meet Moses." So he met Moses at the mountain of God and kissed him. Then Moses told Aaron everything the Lord had sent him to say and also about all the signs he'd commanded him to perform. If you remember, he'd been told to go and tell Pharaoh to let God's people free, and he'd been told to perform certain signs with his staff, his, you know, not his employees, the rod in his hand, that would hopefully convince Pharaoh to let the people go. So Moses told Aaron all about that. He was brought into the picture. Moses and Aaron then brought together all the elders of the Israelites, and Aaron told them everything the Lord had said to Moses. He also performed the signs before the people, and they believed. And when they heard that the Lord was concerned about them and had seen their misery, they bowed down and worshipped. This was a wonderful start to the plan. The people of God were immediately convinced that God was on their side, actively involved, and about to set them free. It appears that the signs were convincing, the message was convincing, and now they were on board with this too. Very optimistic moment. Yes? Okay, we'll read on. Afterwards, Moses and Aaron went to Pharaoh and repeated the process. And so they said, "This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. Let my people go so that they may hold a festival to me in the wilderness." Now, I wonder if they'd expected the same response they just got when they declared it to the Hebrews. Maybe God had said something. God had promised something. God appeared to be on the move and doing something. I wonder if their anticipation was, this is an unstoppable force now. But Pharaoh said, "Who is the Lord that I should obey him and let Israel go? I do not know the Lord, and I will not let Israel go." Okay, what do you do now? Well, Moses and Aaron seemed a bit taken aback, so they thought, okay, that was a bit unexpected. It wasn't supposed to be like that. That wasn't in the script, was it? So they come back at him and have another go. They said, "The God of the Hebrews has met with us. Now let's take a 3-day journey into the wilderness to offer sacrifices to the Lord our God, or he may strike us with plagues or with the sword." Notice as an aside how little they knew their God at this point. They were acting in the best knowledge of God that they had, but actually they got God's character all wrong. God had never said that. They concluded that God was probably like that because that's the way the gods they knew were. And so they overlaid a bit of their understanding of the Egyptian gods onto the true God and kind of got a bit mixed up. And God allowed that to happen. God had never said that he was going to strike them with plagues if they weren't going to go. The Hebrews, that is. But the king of Egypt said, "Moses and Aaron, why are you taking the people away from their labor? Get back to your work." Then Pharaoh said, "Look, the people of the land are now numerous and you're stopping them from working." Early shop stewards, perhaps. That same day, Pharaoh gave this order to the slave drivers and overseers in charge of the people. "You are no longer to supply the people with straw for making bricks. Let them go and gather their own straw, but require them to make the same number of bricks as before. Don't reduce the quota. They're lazy. That's why they're crying out, 'Let us go and sacrifice to our God.' It's a skiving tactic. Make the work harder for the people so that they keep working and pay no attention to lies." Then the slave drivers and the overseers went out and said to the people, "This is what Pharaoh says, 'I will not give you any more straw. Go and get your own straw from wherever you can find it, but your work will not be reduced at all.' So the people scattered all over Egypt to gather stubble to use for straw. The slave drivers kept pressing them, saying, "Complete the work required of you for each day, just as when you had the straw." And Pharaoh's slave drivers beat the Israelite overseers they had appointed, demanding, "Why haven't you met your quota of bricks yesterday or today as before?" Then the Israelite overseers went and appealed to Pharaoh. "Why have you treated your servants this way? Your servants are given no straw, yet we're told, make bricks. Your servants are being beaten, but the fault is with your own people." Pharaoh said, "Lazy. That's what you are, lazy. That's why you keep saying, 'Let's go and sacrifice to the Lord.' Now get to work. You will not be given any straw, yet you must produce your full quota of bricks." The Israelite overseers realized that they were in trouble when they were told, "You're not to reduce the number of bricks required of you each day." And when they left Pharaoh, they found Moses and Aaron waiting to meet them. Moses and Aaron might have been better hiding at this point, but they found Moses and Aaron waiting to meet them. And they said, "May the Lord look on you and judge you. You've made us obnoxious to Pharaoh and his officials and have put a sword in their hand to kill us." Moses returned to the Lord and said, "Why, Lord? Why have you brought trouble on the people? Is this why you sent me? Ever since I went to Pharaoh to speak in your name, he's brought trouble on this people, and you've not rescued your people at all." And the Lord said to Moses, "Now, you will see what I will do to Pharaoh. Because of my mighty hand, he will let them go. Because of my mighty hand, he will drive them out of his country." Interesting end to the story there, as Moses wrestles with something that perhaps some of us wrestle with sometimes. Where is God? We thought God had promised that he would do something. We thought that God would do something in response to our obedience. We've stepped out for him. We've got out of the boat and we're sinking. Why? Why has it gone wrong when we've done what we were told to do? Why isn't God doing what he promised he would do? Perhaps you've never thought that way. You're very holy here, I know, in the second service. You're noted for your sanctification. But many of us hit patches in our lives where we ask God, why have you stopped working? We've done what we think is our bit, but everything seems to be going backwards, not forwards. It's a very human response that Moses has. He goes to God and says, "Why? Why are you not doing what you said you'd do?" Because what God had said he would do, this wonderful big word that hangs over the whole book of Exodus, freedom, he would set his people free. That was the promise, that he would send Moses to Pharaoh and tell Pharaoh that he was going to bring his people out of Egypt. Freedom. The book of Exodus has been used by all kinds of freedom movements, some Christian, some not Christian. The imagery from Exodus has been used by all kinds of people over the years to underpin this idea of setting people free, being made free. And it's an idea that the New Testament also picks up in terms of our lives as Christians. So in the book of Galatians, Paul writes this: "It's for freedom that Christ has set us free. Stand firm then, and do not let yourselves be burdened again by a yoke of slavery." Can you see the Exodus language there? We find it trickling out in all sorts of different places, bubbling up from beneath the surface throughout the New Testament, as the New Testament writers use this story to impress on the first Christians that this is their story too, that God wants to set them free, that God's acted in their time and in their lives to set them free from the things that oppress them. That's the kind of God he is. He sets captives free. Do you remember Jesus said that? His job description in Luke chapter 4, when he stood up in his hometown synagogue in Nazareth, read from the scroll of the prophet Isaiah, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has equipped me, he's empowered me to announce freedom to the captives." Jesus himself used the Exodus imagery to describe his own ministry and mission. "I've come to set people free." A lot of people live lives knowing they're bound up in certain ways. The good news is that there is a liberator, and the liberator's in this room. The liberator's at loose in this world. God is a liberator. Why does he do it? Why does God want to set people free? We'll talk about more what they might be set free from in a moment. But firstly, why does he do it? Well, we're told in Exodus it's because God is responding to the pain of his people. The Lord told Moses, I've seen the oppression of my people in Egypt. I've heard their cries of distress because of their harsh slave drivers. I'm aware of their sufferings, so I've come down to rescue them. Isn't that a wonderful picture of God? This God that responds, that enters into, that feels. 300 years or so before Jesus lived, there was a Greek philosopher called Aristotle. Some of you look completely uninterested in that fact, but it's a truth. You can like it or not. It's just a fact. There's a man called Aristotle. He's a Greek philosopher, a very wise man, respected. And he began to think about why the world is the way it is. And he was aware that the world was changing all the time. Things were moving and things were changing around him. And he thought, how can that be? Is that all that the world is, just this kind of flux of change and turmoil? And he reasoned through that somewhere or other, there must have been something that started all the movement that there was in the world. All the change that was happening must have come from somewhere. That's what he thought. And somewhere, he reasoned, there must be something, some solid thing, some unchanging thing that was the cause of all the other things moving. And in a sense, the center around which they were moving. I'm sorry to introduce you to Greek philosophy on a Sunday morning, but I thought you might be interested, because it's been very significant, this view. He called that thing, that solid, dependable thing that triggers movement in anything else, change and so on, the unmoved mover. That's what he called it, the unmoved mover. Wind the history clock forward a few centuries to the 13th century, and you come to a man called Thomas Aquinas, who was a Christian philosopher and scholar and a friar. And he began to think about, how could we prove that God really exists? And he used Aristotle's ideas in his proof of why there must be a God. Surely, all of this can't have just come from nowhere. All of this changing and developing and evolving world can't have just come from nowhere. There must have been something that started it all. And that something must be perfect. All that we're seeing is a kind of a reflection of that perfect something that started everything. And he actually used the language of Aristotle to describe God. He said there must be an unmoved mover somewhere that started all of this stuff that we see happening around us. And that idea that God is an unmoved mover passed into traditional Christian thought for centuries, right up to the present day. Another long word for you, immutable. There's a belief that God is immutable. That means he can't mutate, he can't change. The idea is he's so perfect, if he changed, necessarily, he would be less than perfect. How can you improve on perfection? So there's a kind of a logical stream, if you're following this at all, and some of you are thinking about the wedding yesterday, and I know that, but if you're following this at all, it's important, believe me. There's a logical train of thought, philosophical thought there, which deduces that there must be something that caused all this thing, and this thing that started all cannot change, because if it changed, it would be diminished in some way, because it started off being perfect. It is immovable and immutable and unmovable. Now, that view of God has passed into certain Christian traditions and colored people's idea of God as this somewhat fixed, deterministic, controlling deity who makes everything happen, whether we like it or not. He's not surprised by anything. He doesn't interact with anything. He doesn't change his mind about anything, because he's immutable and he's fixed and he's sovereign in that sense. I want to challenge you to read the Bible and the way the Bible talks about God. And it's really hard to understand and to get to that point by reading the Bible that the philosophers got to by doing their philosophy. God is not, in this story, God is not an unmoved mover. He is deeply moved. He's deeply connected. He feels the pain of his people. There's a Hebrew scholar called Abraham Heschel. I didn't sneeze, that's his name. Abraham Heschel. And he wrote a very fat, an interesting book called The Prophets, trying to work out how the prophets in the Old Testament did their work. And his argument is, thinking of the Jewish prophets in the Old Testament, that they weren't responding to some sort of hotline to God, but they were responding to God's heart, the way that God felt. They empathized with God's, what he called God's pathos, God's ability to feel what's going on in his world. And when they spoke out of that sense of God's heart of longing or frustration or desire. That seems to me to be much more true to the God that we read about throughout Scripture. There's a lovely book that's written by an antidote to the unmoved mover idea, and the book is called The Most Moved Mover by a man called Clark Pinnock, who's one of my theological heroes. He had incredibly thick glasses. I'm not sure that all theologians need to have that, but he did. It's Most Moved Mover. And he argues for a view of God, which is a view of God which I think is much more true to Scripture, a God who interacts, who connects, who responds to real choices that people make. He doesn't determine everything, but he's actually interacting with his creation. Here, God is interacting with his all. When people are set free, they're set free because God is compassionate. You know what the word compassion means? I feel with you. I suffer with you. The word passion means suffering. The passion of Christ is his suffering. It means I am with you in your suffering. That's what compassion means. I feel what you're feeling. That's our God. That should encourage us. Because we read that he enters into that experience of life that we have, but he can cope with it. See, sometimes we think, well, God must be an unmoved mover because if he really knew how I felt, he'd be disgusted or he'd write me off. If he really knew what was going on in my heart, he wouldn't want it. So we want there to be a bit of distance because we are fearful that God can't cope with what we're experiencing in life. But when we read the scriptures, and particularly when we read the Psalms, we read that God is deeply able to connect with the worst of our humanity, our doubts, our fears, our anger, our longings, our frustrations. We have a most moved mover as a God. And that should encourage us enormously. A God who interacts with our lives. He set the people free. Because if you're being set free, the presupposition is that you're captive. If you're not captive, you can't be set free. It was obvious that the Israelites were captive. They were captive to Pharaoh, this great God-like figure in the book of Exodus, this figure who sets himself up in opposition to God as an alternative God, scoffingly saying, "Who is the Lord that I should obey him and let Israel go?" In brackets, "I determine what goes on around here. I'm God in this place. I don't know that Lord, and I will not let Israel go." Now, that power that Pharaoh represents, controlling people, oppressing people, as the Bible develops, that thought of an oppressive power that controls and distorts people's lives comes into different focus in the New Testament. It comes into focus not in a person, but in a spiritual form. It's called Satan or the devil in the New Testament, a spiritual opponent to God's people. Equally oppressive, equally willing and desiring to distort life. We read, for example, in Ephesians, a book written to Christians, "You used to live in sin, just like the rest of the world, obeying the devil." Well, I didn't know I did that. I wasn't a devil worshipper. I never went to any sort of dramatic black witch ceremonies or even white witch ceremonies. I just never went there. What do you mean, Paul, that I used to obey the devil? The commander of the powers in the unseen world. He is the spirit at work in the hearts of those who refuse to obey God. I'm sure what Paul is not saying is that the whole world are devil worshippers. But what he is saying is there's a malign influence at work in this world which is controlling hearts and minds and lives and stopping them, as he later says in another place, being able to connect with the true and living God. Just as Pharaoh was trying to stop people connecting with the true and living God and keeping them in his patch, under his control, so Satan wants to do exactly the same thing. Paul says he blinds people's eyes. The God of this age has blinded the minds of unbelievers so they cannot see the light of the gospel that displays the glory of Christ, who is the image of God. There's a spiritual blindness that comes on people, and we need to be set free from that. It's not something that we can think our way out of any more than the Israelis could work their way out of the brickyards. We need to be liberated from that. And if we cannot yet see Christ clearly, then we need some blinkers to be taken off our eyes. And that is a spiritual transaction. It's not about convincing people with clever arguments why God exists and why there's suffering in the world and all of those things which are interesting to discuss, but it's a spiritual transaction when God, like he did for the Apostle Paul on the road to Damascus, lets the scales fall from someone's eyes and you see Jesus clearly for the first time. That's what it means to come to faith, to have that spiritual, as John describes it, born-againness, being spiritually brought to life where previously you were blind and dead and deaf in your spiritual faculties. Now, the trouble is with this external power that wants to oppress us and keep our lives distorted and wants to keep us focused on the wrong things and living our lives for the wrong reasons, that gets inside of us. Did you notice when I read the reading off the screen that the Israelis had internalized Pharaoh's view of them? So in one sense, Pharaoh was oppressing them. But on the other hand, they'd taken that message on board and they're quite capable of oppressing themselves. So we read in verse 15, the Israelite overseers went and appealed to Pharaoh. How do they describe themselves? When they spoke to Pharaoh, what did they say? They said, why have you treated your servants this way? Your servants are given no straw, yet we're told make bricks. Your servants. And in the Hebrew language and in the Hebrew Bible, to make a point, the writers repeat things. So when we see things repeated, we know that's the point of this bit. The point is that the Hebrews had stopped thinking of themselves as children of God and begun to internalize Pharaoh's message of being a slave and said, yeah, that's what we are, you're your servants. That's our identity. There's something inside of us now that believes we're actually different to who God sees us as being. We've lost our sense of identity. And that's a bit like Paul describes in the book of Romans when he talks about that struggle we have, not with external forces, but with our own hearts, that are sort of almost like, well, we've internalized that rebellion against God. Somehow or other, we've begun to believe differently about ourselves than what God believes, and we've begun to feel restricted in what we can do. Paul puts it in Romans 7 like this: I've discovered this principle of life, that when I want to do what's right, I inevitably do what's wrong. Ever had that feeling? I often have that feeling, I must confess to you. I love God's law with all my heart. I think it's great that God said, don't lie. I think it's great that God said, don't commit adultery, that God said, don't envy. I think, well, that's great. I love God's law with my mind. But there's another power at work within me that's at war with my mind. It's not out there, it's in here. This power makes me a slave. Notice again the Exodus language. This power makes me a slave to the sin that's still within me. Oh, what a miserable person I am. Who will free me? Notice again the Exodus language of liberation. Who will free me from the life that's dominated by sin and death? Thank God. The answer is in Jesus Christ, our Lord. And then in the next chapter, Romans chapter 8, he goes on to say, the law that's at work within you, that's holding you back, that's keeping you captive from being the person you want to be, can be trumped by a higher law. Just like an aeroplane, you know, I was having a conversation with someone in a car last night at 10:30 about how an aeroplane takes off. What do I know about how an aeroplane takes off? I don't know, but I made something up, and apparently I checked it in the first service, and it was almost accurate. That when it's on the runway, it's subject to one force, and that's the force of gravity. It's keeping it locked on the ground. But there are other laws that come into play as the aeroplane moves at speed along the runway, the laws of aerodynamics. And because of the laws of aerodynamics, it can lift off and almost appear to defy the law of gravity as long as the laws of aerodynamics are in operation. If they stop operating, the law of gravity takes over again. But let's not go there. Let's live with the first bit of the idea. There are a set of laws that trump what is actually a basic law for everyone. Most of us live every day under the law of gravity, not the laws of aerodynamics. In other words, we're located on the ground, we don't float or fly. Just as most people live every day under this law that Paul's describing, the law of sin and death. But there's a higher law, which in Romans chapter 8, Paul describes as the law of the Spirit, which has set us free from the law of sin and death. We can be set free. In fact, it's already happened. Again, notice the Exodus language here in Colossians. You should be filled with joy, you Christians, always thanking the Father, because he's enabled you to share in the inheritance that belongs to his people who live in the light. For he has rescued us from the kingdom of darkness, brackets, Egypt/Pharaoh, close brackets. And he's transferred us into the kingdom of his dear Son, Jesus, who purchased our freedom and forgave our sins. Two completely different ways of living, two completely different masters, two completely different lords and gods. An oppressive dictator who wants to crush us and make us make bricks without straw and just hold us down, and a liberator who wants to set us free, who came to set the captives free. I know I'm glad which God I have come to know through his grace. One final thought before I give you the final thought. I guess you'd call that a penultimate thought. This journey of freedom is just that. The Hebrews, the Israelites, took a long time to actually inherit their freedom. There was a moment at which they passed through the Red Sea. But you will know if you've read the story, and some spoiler alerts here, but it was ages. And there's a well-known saying that sums this up. It took a moment for God to get Israel out of Egypt, but it took a lifetime to get Egypt out of Israel. They carried those memories. They carried those fears. They wanted to go back to Egypt when things got tough. They thought somehow it was better back there when suddenly the life in the wilderness, on their freedom journey was a challenging journey. And sometimes for us as Christians, we know the truth that on the cross, Jesus died to set us free. But we struggle because our journey of life doesn't feel very free sometimes. That's why the book of Exodus is such a wonderful gift. That's why the lives of the apostles, particularly Peter, is such a wonderful gift. It's a lifetime of living into the freedom inheritance that Jesus died to give us. We are set free and we are being set free. The gospel uses both, the New Testament uses both tenses. You are saved and you are being saved. So be encouraged. If you think it's a bit of a struggle sometimes, you are bang in the center of the way the Bible expects it to be. And if you think somehow or other you've already reached the promised land, well, wonderful. Enjoy the fruit until the rest of us get there. That was my penultimate point. This is my final point. We're freed from what I've just been describing. But freedom is more than freedom from. It's also freedom for. We're not just set free like, to run wild. I told you a story a while ago, I think, about an experience I had when I was a youngster on the farm where I grew up, where I was unintentionally left in charge of quite a number of young cattle who'd been in the barn over winter and were being moved to a field for the first time. If you've ever seen that happen, they go bonkers. They leap and jump, and they're so happy to be out of that stall and in a big field. And they knew what was coming, somehow or other. Something deep in their cow DNA had informed them that this was about to happen. And I was working with two other people who, because of an accident on the farm, got called away to deal with the accident. And I was left with this 35 or so young cattle penned in the farmyard, space about as big as this. Okay, so you're the 35 cattle, I'm me, all right? And you want to get over there. And I don't want you to at the moment because I can't control you. So I'm standing here with a stick in each hand, trying to make myself look as big as possible, shouting at you, trying to look intimidating and threatening. And you can see it doesn't work very well, does it really, when I do it? And I was saying, just go back, go back, go back, get back in there. And they were saying, no, we're going that way. And their will was greater than my will. At least their ability to achieve their ends was better than my ability to achieve my ends. And they just went. I did it for as long as I could, and I was saying, help, help! And they just went. But of course, they didn't file in a neat, orderly line across the lane and into the field where we'd intended to guide them. They just went. Some of them went up the lane, some of them went down the lane, some of them went along the farm track, some of them went into the neighboring village. It was days. We were getting phone calls on the farm for days saying, we found a cow. Is that anything to do with you? Yes. Well, it might be, actually, yes, strangely. And it was the days before electronic tagging and all that sort of stuff, so we sort of made a best guess. It's probably one of ours, because we lost several the other day. And there were a couple that we never found, so they probably ended up in the butchers or something somewhere, I don't know. But is that the kind of, is that the image of freedom? For some Christians, it seems to be that, that God has set me free so I can do what I want now. Paul says in the New Testament, doesn't he, that God has set us free, but liberty shouldn't turn into license. We're set free from, but we're also set free for. And what we're set free for is to be a worshiper. Moses was told, when you've brought the people out of Egypt, you will worship God on this mountain. Moses said to Pharaoh, let my people go so they may hold a festival to me in the wilderness. This idea of being released to be a worshiper is central to the Exodus story. But what does it mean? It certainly doesn't mean that they were set free to form a choir and sing songs. Worship here doesn't mean to be a singer of songs or a raiser of hands. To worship is to center your life around some object of ultimate worth. To center your life around some object of ultimate worth. You are worth everything, and so I'm going to live for you. They were set free to worship their God, to recenter their life and their lives as a community around the true and living God, to turn their back on the oppressive God who'd offered them work of a sort and homes of a sort, and to risk everything by traveling across the desert to a God they didn't really know that well, and to say, you are the true God. He was the false God. We are going to live our lives now for you. What you say goes. What you ask of us happens. When you move, we'll move. When you stay put, we'll stay put. That's what it means to worship God. Singing is part of it. But worship is about centering our lives around some object of ultimate worth, God. And that's what they were called to do, to move to the mountain, to hear what their God required of them, and to center their lives around him. That's what we're all called to do as Christians. When we're set free from, we are set free for life in the kingdom of God, life under Jesus as Lord, life centered around a new object of ultimate worth. God, what you say goes. I will build my life on this foundation now, and I've moved away from that foundation. That's what it means to be a worshiper, and that's what God called people to do, and he still calls people to do. It confuses God enormously when we claim to be a worshiper, but we don't live a life of worship. Jesus said to his disciples, I think somewhat puzzled, why do you call me Lord, but you don't do what I say? It doesn't add up. Don't do it. Do what I say, and then I'll know I'm your Lord. So, call to a life of obedience in this wonderful, healthy kingdom. Set free. The promise of freedom made to God's people, made to all people through Jesus Christ. Freed by a compassionate God. Freed from all kinds of captivity, the out there and the in there sorts. On that journey of becoming free to become a worshiper of the true God. It's for freedom that Christ has set us free. Stand firm then, and don't let yourselves be burdened by a yoke of slavery.